Military leadership. Many talk about it, write about it, but what makes a leader great? Is leadership innate? Is it learned? Or does it exist in some unique combination of the innate and learned in all great leaders? To try to answer these questions, the MacArthur Memorial Leadership Podcast Series will explore the education, personality, abilities, and legacies of great military leaders and the institutions and times that produced them. The following is an interview with U.S. Army Major Andrew Forney about General John J. Pershing. Major Forney has served in Afghanistan and Iraq and is currently working on a PhD in history. At the time of this interview, Major Forney is an instructor in history at the United States Military Academy at West Point. Today we're here at West Point with Major Forney, an instructor in the American History Program here, and we're going to be talking about John J. Pershing. Major Forney, can you just describe West Point during the time that Pershing was here as a student?
Yes, and first of all, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you about Pershing. Pershing graduates in 1886, class of 1886, which will be important as we enter the World War I era because the class of 1886 will end up comprising significant portions of his staff as well as his command elements and the American Expeditionary Force, or the AEF. For the most part, there aren't huge incremental changes when we look at West Point from before the Civil War to after the Civil War. There is still a heavy focus on engineering. However, there is a military aspect as well as what we might consider a classical education with languages, which Pershing's not very good at, and he'll reminisce about this as he goes to France about his problems with learning French while he was here. But in many regards, it is still an engineering school with a military element, but also much of a finishing school. At this point, West Point is still regarded as almost a form of political patronage for the well-to-do. And only in a few instances do we have the idea of social mobility kind of coming up through the ranks. That's really going to become more prominent as we enter the 20th century and post-World War I. But for all intents and purposes, you know, Pershing's from Missouri, from a smaller farm. His dad is involved in local politics, and he works his way in the Gilded Age era to political prominence in the local area, and that's what gets Pershing into West Point. When we look at Pershing here at West Point as a student, he likes to go down to Flirtation Walk with some of the local ladies quite a bit, and he does appear to imbibe the culture of standards and discipline and regimentation here. He does okay as a student, not necessarily a standout, but he does relatively well. He's mainly known as being friendly with the ladies, dancing, as well as internalizing those elements of the discipline and the regimentation that he sees here at West Point, which, again, we'll see reflected as he takes command of the AEF going forward.
Is he considered a very popular cadet while he's here? Because there's all those stories of people years after World War I that say, oh, when I knew him at West Point, I knew he was marked for leadership.
You know, one of the things that's really interesting about Pershing as you look at his career, beginning here at West Point going forward, is he's not necessarily, I think, conceived of as being in the in crowd until necessarily we get to the Philippines. And you look at his early career, it's very much doing these kind of standard jobs or job nobody wants. He commands a troop of Indian scouts. He commands a troop in the Buffalo Soldiers. His Spanish-American War experience is with the 10th Cavalry, which is a Buffalo Soldier outfit. And in many times throughout his career, you see him preparing for civilian life. So, you know, he will get a law degree while he's at the University of Nebraska as a basic and ROTC instructor. So he never necessarily stands out, but I do believe that you can see indications of his future success at his time here at West Point. The connections he makes here at West Point, he's going to further surround himself with talent, which is going to become one of the hallmarks of Pershing going forward, is his ability to surround himself with talented people, with a network of individuals that help him politically and militarily. The connections he makes here at West Point, he'll be reaching back to pick people for his staff in France that he knew from the class of 86. And so I think that's key as we look at his time here. He may have not been stellar. You know, he wasn't the king of the football field or number one in his class. But we do see him working a network of talent beginning here that will continue to develop in his time in the Army.
You kind of mentioned he gets his law degree. He does a few other things. Is he one of these guys that read a biography when he was a little boy of Napoleon and wanted to be a career military officer? Or is he somebody who kind of does this and then just ends up sticking with it or keeps getting selected for new assignments? Or
I think all the way up to the Philippines, he goes back and forth between getting out of the Army and staying in the Army. In the United States, the 1880s, 1890s, the Army is not seen as a bright career path. After the Civil War, the Congress has cut the budget of the Army, and so you have several successive iterations of budget cuts and downsizing, which prevent officer advancement, officer promotion. So he'll go into the Spanish-American War. 1886, he gets in. Spanish-American War, 1898, he's still a first lieutenant. So his advancement is quite slow, which then is contrast later on when you see a very meteoric rise in his career going forward. And so I think all the way up until his first experiences in the Philippines, really he sees that he has this feel for not necessarily just warfare, but dealing with individuals and dealing with diverse cultures that I think pay off with him down the road. And once he gets a feel for that, he kind of gets bit by the bug, and now he starts looking for, how do I make my career progress? How do I see myself going forward? And how do I get those jobs that will pave the way for me for future success?
Can you talk a little bit about his early career?
By graduating in 1886, he's going to miss the bulk of the Indian Wars. Most of the Indian Wars are going to peter out by 1880, and he will be with the 6th Cavalry while they chase Geronimo. But for all intents and purposes, it's not battle, per se, or the warfare that we see in the 1870s against the Sioux or against the Nez Perce or anything along those lines. And he'll do some very, what we consider to be junior officer jobs in the Army. He's a platoon leader, he works on staff in the 6th Cavalry, he bounces around in Arizona to several different posts. He likes being on campaign, he does like that. He then will take becoming commander of the Indian Scouts. In 1890, the Indian Scouts, which had existed prior to that, but in an informal way to the Army, after 1890, the Indian Scouts are fully incorporated as a legitimate element in the United States Army. And so Pershing will take a troop command of the Indian Scouts for about a year. And this is the first instance where we really see Pershing as the Army's first imperial officer. And I know, you know, saying that America has an empire is a contentious issue, but I use the term imperial officer because what we see is he takes these jobs that advance the greater expanse of the United States, for lack of a better term. So this is the first job that does that, because what we see is not only is he kind of solidifying control of the West, that's already kind of in decline, but he has the ability now, beginning with this job, to operate with different cultures and not in the kind of the racist or negative overtones that so many other people see that job. So he's going to see positions, you know, starting with the Indian Scouts and with the 10th Cavalry and the Buffalo Soldiers, he'll see these as positions of meaning, and he will treat them well. Now, is he having Indian Scouts or Buffalo Soldiers over to his home for dinner? No. I mean, this is still a racialized era. But what we do see is his ability to take these jobs and excel, not just with his higher headquarters, but with his soldiers. By all intents and purposes, when we look at his time with the Indian Scouts and with the Buffalo Soldiers, he's very well regarded. He's thought to be very fair with the soldiers and to work to take care of his soldiers, particularly on campaign as well as back in garrison. The flip side of that is at the time, people are seeing him taking these jobs and saying, your career's over. You're not going anywhere. That particularly being a troop commander in the Buffalo Soldier regiments is the kiss of death. And Indian Scouts is not necessarily a way to advancement. And so again, as he kind of muddles with the idea of, do I stay in the military or do I become civilian? This is very much in his mind. He has taken these jobs because they were available or because he was selected for them before the Mexican War, before 1895. He has got the kiss of death if we're going to look and see how the future of his career is going to go.
Can you describe his thoughts on race? Because to be in charge of African-American group of soldiers like the Buffalo Soldiers and people saying, yes, this is a kiss of death, is he doing it because he sees it as a potential springboard possibly to something else, or because, you know, it's the job he's been given?
I think it's the latter. Even if Pershing is not necessarily in his early career ambitious to be a general someday, I think he has an ambitious and he was willing to accept new challenges. Now, if I were to say that he was progressive on the issues of race for the 1890s, that may not be saying too much. I do think when you look at kind of the common perceptions of race this time period, he's probably ahead of the power curve. He's probably ahead somewhat when we think about other racial issues. I mean, this is the time period where people are measuring people's skulls and saying that the heat in Africa made them unable to do math problems. I mean, some really, what we look now is very nasty stuff, and his experience kind of away from the greater society is going to, I think, see them as soldiers. And I think that's what he does. He sees them as soldiers and sees his job as leading soldiers. And I think that's what he really conceives of the job. As he's wrestling with the idea of getting out or staying in, he's not going to really be worried about the kiss of death. He's going to see another challenge, and if this is going to end his career, so be it. That's kind of his mentality. He's very well regarded, again, by the higher headquarters as well as the soldiers around him as he does these tasks, which will get him further and further different jobs, which, again, kind of outside of the traditional officer development path of that time period.
Pershing eventually comes back to West Point. Mm-hmm. He is an instructor at the academy. Mm-hmm. Can you briefly talk about that time?
Oh, they hate him. He is not a academic instructor. He is a tactical officer, so he is responsible for basically the soldiers in the barracks, their upkeep, their discipline, all those sorts of things. And so when he comes back here, and we see this with grads up all the way up till today, they're like, oh, when I was here, it was so much harder. He comes back, and I think from his experiences that he has in the garrison duties and activities in the Western frontier, he fully believes in discipline, and he fully believes in upholding standards and regulations. And so when he comes and he becomes a TAC officer for his company of cadets here, he starts, in his mind, doing exactly what he's supposed to be doing when it comes to making sure they're in uniform, making sure their rooms are clean, making sure their weapons are clean, and he is hated. Two stories that really stick out. Number one, the company conspires to basically call him to someone's room, and they did the old put the bucket of water on the door trick. And so they were going to have him open the door, and the bucket of water was going to fall on him, but somebody snitched and told Pershing. And so Pershing let the janitor go and drop the water on him, and then he gave walking hours, which, you know, with your weapon, walking in the, right, for everyone whose room that was. And the other one was, is after this, as he really starts cracking down on standards and regulation, the Corps at that time period had something called being silenced. And so the idea was, when you walk into the dining facility, everyone's quiet, and no one says a word. And that is them showing their disapproval of you. And so Pershing walks in, and there's complete silence. And so he says, that's fine. And so and they had just begun eating. And so he said, that's fine. He calls his entire regiment to attention and tells them to leave the chow hall. And so no one ate. From all accounts, we see this time period never phases him, never breaks him. He firmly believes in the standards and discipline that he learned here at West Point and that he saw reinforced in the Western frontier. You know, that idea of people saying, I knew he'd be a general someday. No, the cadets hate his guts. They can't stand him. They think he may be a little bit of a martinet, a parade ground officer. And when the cadets find out that he served with a Buffalo Soldier Regiment, this is where he gets the nickname Blackjack, which is the nicest of the names given to him in this time period, but as a derogatory term due to his time with the Buffalo Soldiers. Blackjack Pershing is typically how we know of him, but at that time period, it was seen as a derogatory term. I have not found anything to say that has indicated how he felt about it, but, you know, by particularly the end of World War I, he's widely known as Blackjack Pershing, so... Way to go, West Point cadets.
And now just to talk a little bit about his eventual meteoric rise. Mm-hmm. You said he was a lieutenant for many, many, many years. Yep. He ends up marrying pretty well. His wife's father has a lot of political influence. Mm-hmm. But he also kind of comes to the notice of Theodore Roosevelt.
Yes.
Can you kind of talk a little bit about his rise in that regard?
He basically leaves West Point because the Spanish-American War breaks out. He gets a job back with the 10th Cavalry Regiment, back with the Buffalo Soldiers, as a quartermaster. But it's also important to remember the Army at this time, kind of an officer is an officer is an officer. So he's not directly in command of troops, but as a quartermaster, he's going to be responsible for logistics, getting everything forward. But we see him, particularly when we start battles at Kettle Hill and San Juan Hill, he is in the thick of the fighting and incredibly cool under pressure. And he's sent by the commander of the regiment repeatedly to hot spots on the line, basically to provide extra guidance and to hold the line, and then they will eventually charge. One of the interesting footnotes of that history is 10th Cavalry. The African-American soldiers actually pretty much break the defenses on San Juan and Kettle Hill, which then allows Theodore Roosevelt's Rough Riders to take the hill and win the day and make him president someday. But there's a story that's very interesting about this, that, you know, Theodore Roosevelt had been a politician. He had followed the career tangentially of Pershing, somebody to watch, I think. One night, again, after the battle is over, Pershing is basically scrounging for supplies. His men had dropped their packs on the side of the road prior to attacking Kettle Hill. Somebody had stolen. So now he's going back trying to find supplies. In the dark, there is a wagon led by some mules, and the wagon master is just cussing up a storm. And Pershing's pretty much like, who is this? And it's like, well, I'm Colonel Teddy Roosevelt, by God. While they might have met before tangentially, here we are in Cuba, and they meet on a road as soldiers. And going forward, that really becomes the development of this relationship and is going to help Pershing with his meteoric rise, and particularly as we see it in the first decade of the 20th century and then into the World War I era. It's going to create some levels of scandal because he is going to pass people over for promotion, which is kind of weird to see this, but he's seen as very young at this time period. He's going to go to the Philippines in 1899 as the hot portion of the Philippine War is breaking down, what we consider the conventional portion. He's going to go and start conducting what we call today civil military operations. He's going to become the military governor of a region. And what we see in this time period is he fully immerses himself in the culture of the Moros. Today, borderline what we'd say going native. He knows the chiefs, he meets with them, and what we see is he is very comfortable, and I think this is a direct result of the work he does with the Indian scouts and the Buffalo soldiers, kind of moving across these lines of race or culture or ethnicity and form linkages with the Moros and work with them going forward. He is seen predominantly as doing a very good job in a non-traditional military role. This is where he's going to come under the eyes of Roosevelt. Roosevelt at this time period is viewing the Philippines War is increasingly becoming that quagmire of insurgency that we know so well of today, and he's looking for a good story. And Roosevelt is going to see what Pershing's doing in the islands. He's going to see this as a great story. And then 1904, he's going to jump about, I think, 100 of the people in front of him in line to be promoted to Brigadier General. And so some people make a lot of this, but this is not uncommon in this time period. It's not the traditional kind of ladder that we see of people moving forward. The same thing kind of happened when we look at the Iraq War with General Petraeus. He is seen as the go-to guy. His promotions are accelerated. And so we see, you know, somebody that had been his boss is now working for him. Does marry this time period to a very well-connected political family. This is a very loving marriage. She will die in a house fire in the Presidio in San Francisco in 1912 or 1913. He's destroyed by this.
And many of his children, too.
Yes, yes.
He's got one son.
Son that survives, right. And so it's a very tragic story, very heartrending story, but not necessarily a marriage, just a marriage of convenience.
Right.
Right place at the right time for Pershing. And they know he's ambitious. You know, at this point, he wants to make the Army career. He sees his role, particularly this time period, in the Pacific, the Philippines, China. He's going to be an observer in the Russo-Japanese War in 1905, 1906. So he sees his job being this kind of imperial officer on the front lines of the American Empire. Continue his work in the Philippines. He'll go back to the Philippines and basically become the commander of the Philippines. And he is very much in tune with that. And at this time period, his relationship to Roosevelt will only help him. And he's seen as a Roosevelt man, which is very interesting when we start to look at the triangle between Wilson, Theodore Roosevelt, and Pershing as we start to mobilize the army.
Moving on to his role in World War I, he is selected kind of abruptly by Wilson. Frederick Funston dies. Mm-hmm. Yep. Everybody kind of panics for a minute. Who's going to lead us in this war in Europe? Wilson meets with Pershing. What do we know about that meeting? It's apparently very kind of short.
It is, but I think we have to remember that Wilson is used to dealing with Pershing from the Mexican expedition. And one of the things that Wilson is going to note from Pershing the Mexican Expedition, he's known as a Roosevelt guy, he's known as a Republican political guy, but he is fully, you are my boss, this is what I do, I execute your tasks. In the Civil War, and even forward in the Spanish-American War, there's a history of American generals or U.S. generals going to the press and voicing their displeasure with the administration. There's a rich history of that. And so what Pershing does is, I mean, he basically says, I'm your guy, you're my boss. And this is really interesting. You talk about this, that we're doing this context of MacArthur, because, you know, MacArthur will reject this in 1950-51, but he is fully in line military subordination to civilian authority. And he doesn't buck against the pressure. We see this again in World War I, where he and Wilson are generally going to be on the same page going forward for the way the battles be fought. Wilson will basically give Pershing carte blanche in France to manage the American Expeditionary Force.
Just to interrupt for a minute, but not in terms of bringing the war to a conclusion, because doesn't Pershing say we need to win this completely?
That's a very good point. And I guess the difference between tactical battles, operational battles, and then the strategic view. And this is one of the things that Pershing is really going to bring to the fore when he comes to France. Because when he comes to France in 1917 and he begins searching the line or walking along the lines, the British and the French lines, he sees two defeated armies. And they have dug in. By 1917, the British are blood white. The French are, you know, multiple corps in their army are revolting. And so he keeps making these comments. I don't hear anybody talking about attacking or going on the advance. And so when Pershing comes to France, his idea of the American army is to attack. This lays the foundation all the way up to today for the American army. We are an offensive army. We can do defense very well, but in our tactics and our doctrine, you have a defense to prepare for the offense. And so Pershing fully says, hey, we are going to attack. We see this happen, you know, in the St. Mihiel Offensive, the Meuse-Argonne. One of the questions we don't know from World War I, because it wraps up so quickly, is these are incredibly bloody battles for the Americans. The French and the British look on and see these frontal attacks, which they have been doing for several years, aren't working. But because the Germans are on the retreat, because they're breaking, they are able to see successes and see advances. Pershing is fully committed to the attack. Who knows what sort of inertia, if that inertia could have kept on. I'm not saying that we should have hit the line and gone defensive, but when you talk about the end of the war, Pershing is fully committed to destroying the enemy. And he has this kind of singular focus, which I think if Pershing potentially has a flaw when we look at his conduct during World War I, because I think for the most part he does an exceptionally well job. You talk about coalition building, you talk about mobilizing an army from basically scratch, getting them on the forest, trained, and sense of war. He has a very good strategic view when it comes to his allies, but I don't think he has a good conception completely of the European balance of power. And so he is going to want to fully attack into Germany, completely destroy the German army, and he is not going to necessarily completely imbibe what Wilson is saying about the League of Nations and bringing complete peace to the world. That one of the things that Pershing sees, is very black and white, which reflects what's going on in American society at this time. So, you know, when Wilson's going to come back to the League of Nations, Pershing, for all intents and purposes, he will stay relatively quiet about it, but he doesn't think that this will fully solve the problems. He's more in line with the French and British views of punishing the Germans going forward, I think.
What's also interesting, I think, about his time in World War I as commander of the American Expeditionary Force is that even though he had that prior experience with the Buffalo Soldiers, in World War I, he kind of caves to pressure from Wilson, I think, mm-hmm. to not have African-American soldiers in combat under U.S. commanders.
I think it's important to remember Wilson's a Jim Crow president. We all remember him coming from Princeton and PhDs, and we have this view of him being very progressive. And, you know, when you start looking at economics and stuff and, you know, graduate progressive income tax, he is a progressive president of the progressive era. But in many regards, he sets back race relations in the United States. He will have a screening of The Birth of the Nation in the White House. He is good friends with the guy who makes the movie. He is from Virginia. He's born and raised in the Shenandoah Valley. And he realizes that the Democratic Party, which he represents, is an amalgamation, a very loose coalition between northern progressive urbans typically associated with the labor movement and the southern power, the solid south of Democrats, of Jim Crow Democrats. Wilson does not have the political capital to have black divisions, black regiments fighting in the regular army. And I don't think Wilson wants that to happen. That is kind of the one caveat to complete control that Wilson will give Pershing. There is also the perception going through the army ranks at this time that African American soldiers do not have the mental capability, and I hate to say this, they don't have the mental capability to fight modern warfare. We see repeatedly that this isn't the case. The Hellfires from Harlem, who are put in with the regiments which put in the French, serve with great distinction. And we see repeatedly where African American regiments that do go into the line serve with incredible amounts of distinction. W.E.B. Du Bois, he is going to encourage black men to enlist, to fight for freedom over there, to bring freedom back here. I think that when it comes down to what African-American soldiers, what they're able to accomplish in the war, and then Pershing not fully integrating them into the AEF, is mainly he did not have the political capital to go against Wilson. And so I think Wilson fully recognized that this was a political issue, and that to win the South, and to maintain the South going forward, he couldn't allow this to happen.
You mentioned coalition building earlier, mm-hmm. and that Pershing is pretty good at doing that with the Allies in World War I. Do you think some of this, again, just comes from his experiences in the Philippines, his experiences in the American West, when he saw the Balkan Wars around mm-hmm. 1908, yep. the Russo-Japanese War?
Right.
Do you believe that he's maybe picked in a way for this job because he has so much international experience, or is that normal?
I don't think that Wilson and Baker looked at him and said, this guy has all this international experience. I really think that his being selected for the AF is more a connection of what he did during the Mexican punitive expedition. But I think it's an added bonus, and I think you're absolutely right. You know, he is comfortable moving among different cultures. And again, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find another officer in this time period who does that. And I think that is what's so unique about Pershing, is he is able to take these opportunities he had and then make the most out of them, so that when he gets to France, he's able to say, hey, I have served with Indian Scouts, I've served with Buffalo Soldiers, I've served in the Philippines, I have met generals from every European nation as I observe these two campaigns. I am fully an international officer. But at the same time, and this is one of the things I find very striking, is when he's in command of the Philippines, he will actually kind of break the inclusive kind of mold of the Army, the kind of the officers club mentality where you, you know, put on your India whites and then go to the officers club. And he says, we need to reach out to the Philippine government and the American government here and incorporate the civilians into our dinners and into our parties and break those bonds. While he's international, he's not an inclusive military guy as well. Feels comfortable with military people, but fully realizes that the Army is part of a greater kind of society and apparatus. And I think that also helps him when it comes to dealing with British prime ministers. He meets Winston Churchill, and they end up developing a good friendship. And the same thing when he gets to France, and he starts meeting their government and their generals there. He's very comfortable moving in these different groups. But at the same time, his guiding idea is that the Americans must form an equal partner in the alliance. The British are pushing for amalgamation, which is what we just do is take American recruits and we just put them in British units. We all speak the same language, won't be a problem. And there's kind of a precedence to this when we see the American Navy sending ships into British convoys under British commanders. And so, you know, they're quick to say the precedence is here. We don't have to have the full train-up or mobilization. We can just take your soldiers and put them right into American units. And Pershing says, no, we're an equal partner. We want our own section of the front. We want our own battle line, and we will contribute to the war effort as full partners. This sets the precedent for coalition warfare that we follow all the way today. Typically, you know, after World War II, we take the lead, but we are equal partners. We will support however we see fit. But as we go forward, this is our goal. Now, he'll concede some where you start to see early in the AAF when they get there. Individual regiments as well, you know, the 3rd Infantry Division will be incorporated into the French line, but he sees this more as a seasoning and training, kind of train-the-trainer mentality, as opposed to amalgamation. So he'll send individual regiments in the line, pull them out, and then those individuals become trainers as the new units come forward. But he fully believes that, and this is Wilson's idea as well, is that the United States is an equal partner, and so there'll be an equal partner in the war, and the idea is there'll be an equal partner in the peace going forward.
So it sounds like Pershing is very much somebody who believes in the idea of the citizen, soldier, obviously civilian control of the military. He's not a soldier kind of in the model of a Prussian Junker or, you know, something like that. Just to conclude, how would you describe his legacy today, both in kind of a broad sense and then a little bit maybe in terms of how he's taught at West Point?
Pershing, I don't think, really ever gets his just due. When you look at all the other generals that come out of here, he's never given the full credit I think he deserves. I think we have to realize he is going to become one of the biggest proponents of professionalizing the military and professionalizing the officer corps. He's a fan of the staff college, the war college. He fully believes in education, that officers should be seeking education as opposed to he rides a horse really good or he shoots really good or he's strong. And I think he realizes in the Russo-Japanese War, as he observes it, we're past the point of the general charging in front of his soldiers to get them motivated. The officer class now has to be a professional class that has an expertise in logistics and in leveraging their capabilities to allow their soldiers to win. And so I think he really modernizes the Army in that regard. I also think that one of his lasting legacies, which is, you know, tumultuous at times, is again this kind of military subordination to civilian control. We see this in the Punitive Expedition, and we see this in World War I, where he is not politically in line with Wilson, but Wilson's his boss. And Wilson's going to tell him he needs to do these things in both conflicts. He's going to execute. The potential could have been there, especially in the Punitive Expedition where things aren't going well. He could have lambasted Wilson in the press, and he doesn't. One of the other things I think that for leaders, be they in the military or in the civilian world, is that Pershing circles himself with talent. And so his aide when he goes to France is Pat. Hugh Drum will become one of his chiefs of staff who will handle nothing but logistics. George Marshall, he leads the war effort in World War II. He never commands a unit, a ground unit in World War I because Pershing recognizes his talent as a staff officer and puts him in place to assist him with staff work. I think the genius of Pershing is, again, number one, you know, taking those jobs where everybody said, you're not going to go anywhere, and using them to his advantage, constantly seeking improvement. And then number two, surrounding himself with talent and realizing that the people around him make him better. And what this does, when we get to France, it frees him up now to focus on the discipline and standards that he focused on while he was here at West Point. So there's numerous stories of him going down the line, inspecting soldiers, a gas mask to see if they worked, inspecting their weapons. So it allows him to internalize the leadership qualities that he feels are important, you know, discipline and adherence to standards. And then, you know, doing whatever he can to make your soldiers win on the battlefield. So I think those are really kind of the two lasting pieces of legacy.
Thank you very much, Major Forney. That was very kind of interesting look at Pershing's life and legacy. We wish you all the best in your future career.
Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening. This has been a production of the General Douglas MacArthur Memorial, a military history museum and research center located in Norfolk, Virginia. If you have any comments or suggestions, please email amanda.williams@norfolk.gov.